So the last time we stopped, as far as I understand it, not at the end of chapter 7, but short after, and we decided to begin from section 14, page 159, 195, sorry. Is
Can
it
you
right?
read the first words of the paragraph? Because,
In the conflict of the claims of society. Yeah,
got it.
okay. Okay. So standards of conduct and spiritual freedom, page 195, paragraph 14. In the conflict of the claims of society. Right?
And the order of reading?
Okay. Now I see Geoffrey, the first, me, I'm always second, then John Robert and Andrea. Do we make a couple of minutes of meditation? Okay.
In the conflict of the claims of society with the claims of the individual, two ideal and absolute solutions confront one another. There is the demand of the group that the individual should subordinate himself more or less completely, or even lose his independent existence in the community. The smaller must be immolated or self-offered to the larger unit. He must accept the need of the society as his own need, the desire of the society as his own desire. He must live not for himself, but for the tribe, clan, commune, or nation of which he is a member. The ideal and absolute solution from the individual standpoint would be a society that existed not for itself, for its all overriding collective purpose, but for the good of the individual and his fulfillment, for the greater and more perfect life of all its members. Representing as far as possible his best self and helping him to realize it, it would respect the freedom of each of its members and maintain itself not by law and force, but by the free and spontaneous consent of its constituent persons. And an ideal society of either kind does not exist anywhere and would be most difficult to create, more difficult still to keep in precarious existence, so long as individual man clings to his egoism as the primary motive of existence. A general but not complete domination of the society over the individual is the easier way, and it is the system that nature from the first instinctively adopts and keeps in equilibrium by rigorous law, compelling custom, and a careful indoctrination of the still subservient and ill-developed intelligence of the human creature.
In primitive societies, the individual life is submitted to rigid and immobile communal custom and rule. This is the ancient and would-be eternal law of the human pack that tries always to masquerade as the everlasting decree of the imperishable, esa dharma sanatana, and the idea is not dead in the human mind. The most recent trend of human progress is to establish an enlarged and sumptuous edition of this ancient turn of collective living towards the enslavement of the human spirit. There is here a serious danger to the integral development of a greater truth upon earth and a greater life. For the desire and free seeking of the individual, however egoistic, however false or perverted they may be in their immediate form, contain in their obscure shell the seed of a development necessary to the whole. His searchings and stumblings have behind them a force that has to be kept and transmuted into the image of the divine ideal. That force needs to be enlightened and trained, but must not be suppressed or harnessed exclusively to society's heavy cartwheels. Individualism is as necessary to the final perfection as the power behind the group spirit. The stifling of the individual may well be the stifling of the God in man. And in the present balance of humanity, there is seldom any real danger of exaggerated individualism breaking up the social integer. There is continually a danger that the exaggerated pressure of the social mass, by its heavy, unenlightened mechanical weight, may suppress or unduly discourage the free development of the individual spirit. For man, in the individual can be more easily enlightened, conscious, open to clear influences. Man in the mass is still obscure, half-conscious, ruled by universal forces that escape its mastery and its knowledge.
Against this danger of suppression and immobilization, nature in the individual reacts. It may react by an isolated resistance, ranging from the instinctive and brutal revolt of the criminal to the complete negation of the solitary and ascetic. It may react by the assertion of an individualistic trend in the social idea, may impose it on the mass consciousness and establish a compromise between the individual and the social demand. But a compromise is not a solution. It only salves over the difficulty and in the end increases the complexity of the problem and multiplies its issues. A new principle has to be called in other and higher than the two conflicting instincts and powerful at once to override and to reconcile them. Above the natural individual law, which sets up as our one standard of conduct the satisfaction of our individual needs, preferences, and desires, and the natural communal law, which sets up as a superior standard the satisfaction of the needs, preferences, and desires of the community as a whole, there had to arise the notion of an ideal moral law, which is not the satisfaction of need and desire, but controls and even coerces or annuls them in the interests of an ideal order that is not animal, not vital and physical, but mental, a creation of the minds seeking for light and knowledge and right rule and right movement and true order. The moment this notion becomes powerful in man, he begins to escape from the engrossing vital and material into the mental life. He climbs from the first to the second degree of the threefold ascent of nature. His needs and desires themselves are touched with a more elevated light of purpose, and the mental need, the ascetic, intellectual, and emotional desire begin to predominate over the demand of the physical and vital nature.
Anyone like a little pause right here since there's a break?
I was just struck by this, although it fits within everything else that he says. At the top of page 197, man in the mass is still obscure, half-conscious, ruled by universal forces, which escape its mastery and knowledge compared to the earlier part, which is the individual. Man in the individual can be more easily enlightened, conscious, open to clear influences. I still think that's very interesting. It's like consistent with the rest, but it says something else there about the struggle we're all having of giving ourselves as a species a kind of species level will towards a better organization of the world, right? This is part of the struggle that's going on now, I think.
Yeah, it's actually interesting that it's now even happening on a global level rather than just national.
Yes, and a global level is what I was thinking. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The natural law of conduct proceeds from a conflict to an equilibrium of forces, impulsions, and desires. The higher ethical law proceeds by the development of the mental and moral nature towards a fixed internal standard, or else a self-formed ideal of absolute qualities, justice, righteousness, love, right reason, right power, beauty, light. It is therefore essentially an individual standard. It is not a creation of the mass mind. The thinker is the individual. It is he who calls out and throws into forms that which would otherwise remain subconscious in the amorphous human whole. The moral striver is also the individual, self-discipline, not under the yoke of an outer law, but in obedience to an internal light, is essentially an individual effort. But by positing his personal standard as the translation of an absolute moral ideal, the thinker imposes it not on himself alone, but on all the individuals whom his thought can reach and penetrate. And as the mass of individuals come more and more to accept it in idea, if only in an imperfect practice or no practice, society also is compelled to obey the new orientation. It absorbs the ideative influence and tries, not with any striking success, to mold its institutions into new forms touched by these higher ideals. But always its instinct is to translate them into binding law, into pattern forms, into mechanic custom, into an external social compulsion upon its living units.
For long after the individual has become partially free, a moral organism capable of conscious growth, aware of an inward life, eager for spiritual progress, society continues to be external in its methods. A material and economic organism, mechanical, more intent upon status and self-preservation than on growth and self-perfection. The greatest present triumph of the thinking and progressive individual over the instinctive and static society has been the power he has acquired by his thought will to compel it to think also, to open itself to the idea of social justice and righteousness, communal sympathy and mutual compassion, to feel after the rule of reason rather than blind custom as the test of its institutions, and to look on the mental and moral ascent of its individuals as at least one essential element in the validity of its laws. Ideally, at least, to consider light rather than force as its sanction, moral development, and not vengeance or restraint as the object of its penal action, is becoming just possible to the communal mind. The greatest future triumph of the thinker will come when he can persuade the individual integer and the collective whole to rest their life relation and its union and stability upon a free and harmonious consent and self-adaptation, and shape and govern the external by the internal truth, rather than to constrain the inner spirit by the tyranny of the external form and structure. So interesting.
Yep. But even this success that he has gained is rather a thing in potentiality than in actual accomplishment. There is always a disharmony and a discord between the moral law in the individual and the law of his needs and desires, between the moral law proposed to society and the physical and vital needs, desires, customs, prejudices, interests, and passions of the caste, the clan, the religious community, the society, the nation. The moralist erects in vain his absolute ethical standard and calls upon all to be faithful to it without regard to consequences. To him, the needs and desires of the individual are invalid if they are in conflict with the moral law and the social law. The moral law and the social law has no claims upon him if it is opposed to his sense of right and denied by his conscience. This is his absolute solution for the individual, that he shall cherish no desires and claims that are not consistent with love, truth, and justice. He demands from the community or nation that it shall hold all things cheap, even its safety and its most pressing interests, in comparison with truth, justice, humanity, and the highest good of the peoples.
no individual rises to these heights except in intense moments. No society yet created satisfies this ideal. And in the present state of morality and of human development, none perhaps can or ought to satisfy it. Nature will not allow it. Nature knows that it should not be. The first reason is that our moral ideals are themselves, for the most part, ill-evolved, ignorant, and arbitrary mental constructions rather than transcriptions of the eternal truths of the spirit. Authoritative and dogmatic, they assert certain absolute standards in theory, but in practice, every existing system of ethics proves either in application unworkable, or is in fact a constant coming short of the absolute standard to which the ideal pretends. If our ethical system is a compromise or a makeshift, it gives at once a principle of justification to the further sterilizing compromises, which society and the individual hasten to make with it. And if it insists on absolute love, justice, right, with an uncompromising insistence, it soars above the head of human possibility and is professed with lip homage, but ignored in practice. Even if it is found that it ignores other elements in humanity which equally insist on survival, but refuse to come, equally it is found that it ignores other elements in humanity which equally insist on survival, but refuse to come within the moral formula. For just as the individual law of desire contains within it invaluable elements of the infinite whole, which have to be protected against the tyranny of the absorbing social idea, the innate impulses too, both of individual and of collective man, contain in them invaluable elements which escape the limits of any ethical formula yet discovered, and are yet necessary to the fullness and harmony of an individual divine perfection. I have a cat on my lap, suddenly.
We can see its tail. Moreover, absolute love, absolute justice, absolute right reason in their present application by a bewildered and imperfect humanity come easily to be conflicting principles. Justice often demands what love abhors. Right reason, dispassionately considering the facts of nature and human relations in search of a satisfying norm or rule, is unable to admit without modification either any reign of absolute justice or any reign of absolute love. And in fact, man's absolute justice easily turns out to be in practice a sovereign injustice. For his mind, one-sided and rigid in its constructions, puts forward a one-sided, partial, and rigorous scheme or figure and claims for it totality and absoluteness and an application that ignores the subtler truth of things and the plasticity of life. All our standards turned into action either waver on a flux of compromises or err by this partiality and unelastic structure. Humanity sways from one orientation to another. The race moves upon a zigzag path led by conflicting claims and, on the whole, works out instinctively what nature intends, but with much waste and suffering, rather than either what it desires or what it holds to be right, or what the highest light from above demands from the embodied spirit.
Comments before I go on?
Yeah, I have some comments. I think this is a really interesting section. on page 198, he's talking about, well, he talks about the greatest present triumph of the thinking and progressive individual. And so I thought the word progressive is interesting there because of the way it's used today in as one of the polarities in social and political life, the progressive versus the conservative. And I've noticed that more than once in Sri Aurobindo's language, that he often uses that word progressive. And I take it to mean in that sense, and since he's using it here. The other thing that I thought was interesting about this is that he's talking about the progressive and thinking individual trying to develop individually in order that, and that will bring about a higher standard in the community. And one of the interesting authors about the experiment of the United States, the political experiment of the United States, Jacob Needleman, has written a book called The American Soul. And in it, he says that the freedom that early American thinkers proposed was not the kind of freedom that we hear about now, which is, you know, it means I can do whatever I want. But it was specifically the freedom so that individuals could develop themselves and could evolve. I don't know whether he uses the word evolve, but develop themselves, to develop their moral qualities and their qualities of goodness. So we have a whole experiment that's been going on, you know, with its all its laws and so on in that regard. And then in the same paragraph at the top of page 199, he talks about the greatest future triumph of the thinker will be when he can persuade the individual integer and the collective whole to come to a kind of harmonious consent on these ideals that he lays forward. And that reminded me of the great law of peace in the Haudenosaunee or Iroquois tradition. The peace giver came and provided this law, and the six tribes have followed that law to some degree, an attempt to make that, to try that experiment and to make that happen. And then the following paragraph, where he talks about the moral individual who develops these really high standards for himself and then tries to make them available to the whole community. That reminded me of all the protest movements. Some of the people that have been involved in these protests have maintained really high standards. One person that I met one time was Daniel Berrigan, who was involved deeply in the protests against the Vietnam War, and who maintained that standard. I mean, I discerned, didn't know him personally. And other people like that, like Dorothy Day and Dr. King. So it seems like Sri Aurobindo was previewing for us in these paragraphs a lot of the things that have happened in our lifetime. Well, not the great law of peace, but some of the other ones.
I also found it interesting. It was what we read at the beginning of the session today, near the beginning anyway, at the top of page 197. So he says, against this danger of suppression and immobilization, nature in the individual reacts. It may react by an isolated resistance ranging from the instinctive and brutal revolt of the criminal to the complete negation of the solitary and ascetic. So it's this criminal that I find interesting, because it's a situation of the criminal as an acting out of a sense of in nonconformism or breaking away from, rather than criminal intent, which is what is normally associated with, right? So it's, I think it's kind of an interesting take on that side of things as well.
Yeah, you have these interesting movements going on in prisons now in San Quentin, and some of the other really the prisons that have a reputation for being really brutal, of mindfulness classes and of work with elements of trauma, where the whole intent is to help people discover kind of what you were talking about, Jeffrey, that what they suffered or what they've been involved in, there are probably personal elements of guilt in them, but there are also these larger forces that are in them that are truer than the actual individual things they might have done.
Aurobindo made his own experience in jail, no? He knows very well. Yeah, I think it's true. I wanted only just to point out, in fact, one thing that what you said, John Robert, about the notion of freedom. That's a very important topic nowadays, because everyone is speaking about freedom, but it's not really clear what we mean by that, because I think there are different types of freedom. And in fact, I don't think that it is a coincidence that Aurobindo is speaking of spiritual freedom. He did not just speak of freedom generally, abstractly, but spiritual freedom. Yeah, but I don't know, he doesn't dwell much in this chapter on this, but it would be interesting to make a research or find out what's the difference between spiritual freedom and other kind of freedoms. And as you say, we have nowadays this conception of freedom as to do whatever we want. Is this spiritual freedom? I don't know. I don't think so. Because there is also the spiritual, the freedom of the ego. That's my expression, yeah. Where I'm feel to be free, whatever I want, without responsibility, and without thinking how my freedom may impact the others. Yeah. But it's a tricky thing, because I think every one of us has a bit different concept of what freedom is or should be. But it's a very actual topic.
Well, sure, because it comes up with the anti-maskers, right? I am free not to wear a mask. Never mind that it might hurt other people not to wear one, but I'm free to do whatever I want, you know? So
Although, I
always think about these things, you know, so we can look at the world and the state of the resistance to the mask wearing and the vaccination and these kinds of things as being bad things. And they are bad in a kind of a way. But I also get this sense that if the world is going to change, these things have to rise to the surface. They have to rub shoulders with other people. So in some sense, I kind of think that even the anti-vax movement is a kind of a flexing of a muscle that is on the way out. And that this is a kind of a working out of stuff rather than a, you know, necessarily an all bad movement. You know? Anyway, I hope so, but I don't think it's just wishful thinking on my part. Shall I keep reading? The fact is that when we have reached the cult of absolute ethical qualities and erected the categorical imperative of an ideal law, we have not come to the end of our search or touched the truth that delivers. There is, no doubt, something here that helps us to rise beyond limitation by the physical and vital man in us, an insistence that overpasses the individual and collective needs and desires of a humanity still bound to the living mud of matter in which it took its roots, an inspiration that helps to develop the mental and moral being in us. This new sublimating element has been, therefore, an acquisition of great importance. Its workings have marked a considerable step forward in the difficult evolution of terrestrial nature. And behind the inadequacy of these ethical conceptions, something too is concealed that does attach to a supreme truth. There is here the glimmer of a light and power that are part of a yet unreached divine nature. But the mental idea of these things is not that light, and moral formulation of them is not that power. These are only representative constructions of the mind that cannot embody the divine spirit, which they vainly endeavor to imprison in their categorical formulas. Beyond the mental and moral being in us is a greater divine being that is spiritual and supermental. It is only through a large spiritual plane where the mind's formulas dissolve in a white flame of direct inner experience that we can reach beyond the mind and pass from its constructions to the vastness and freedom of the supermental realities. There alone can we touch the harmony of the divine powers that are poorly misrepresented to our mind and framed into a false figure by the conflicting or wavering elements of the moral law. There alone the unification of the transformed vital and physical and the illumined mental man becomes possible in that supermental spirit which is at once the secret source and goal of our mind and life and body. There alone is there any possibility of an absolute justice, love, and right, far other than that which we imagine, at one with each other in the light of a supreme divine knowledge. There alone can there be a reconciliation of the conflict between our members.
In other words, there is, above society's external law and man's moral law, and beyond them, though feebly and ignorantly aimed at by something within them, a larger truth of a vast, unbound consciousness, a law divine towards which both these blind and gross formulations are progressive, faltering steps that try to escape from the natural law of the animal to a more exalted light or universal rule. That divine standard, since the Godhead in us is our spirit moving towards its own concealed perfection, must be a supreme spiritual law and truth of our nature. Again, as we are embodied beings in the world with a common existence and nature, and yet individual souls capable of direct touch with the transcendent, this supreme truth of ourselves must have a double character. It must be a law and truth that discovers the perfect movement, harmony, rhythm of a great spiritualized collective life and determines perfectly our relations with each being and all beings in nature's varied oneness. It must be at the same time a law and truth that discovers to us at each moment the rhythm and exact steps of the direct expression of the divine in the soul, mind, life, body of the individual creature. Footnote. Therefore, the Gita defines Dharma, an expression which means more than either religion or morality, as action controlled by our essential manner of self-being. And we find in experience that this supreme light in force of action, in its highest expression, is at once an imperative law and an absolute freedom. It is an imperative law because it governs by immutable truths our every inner and outer movement. And yet, at each moment and in each movement, the absolute freedom of the Supreme handles the perfect plasticity of our conscious and liberated nature.
The ethical idealist tries to discover this supreme law in his own moral data, in the inferior powers and factors that belong to the mental and ethical formula. And to sustain and organize them, he selects a fundamental principle of conduct essentially unsound and constructed by the intellect. Utility, hedonism, reason, intuitive conscience, or any other generalized standard. All such efforts are foredoomed to failure. Our inner nature is the progressive expression of the eternal spirit, and too complex a power to be tied down by a single dominant mental or moral principle. Only the supramental consciousness can reveal to its differing and conflicting forces their spiritual truth and harmonize their divergences.
The later religions endeavor to fix the type of a supreme truth of conduct, erect a system, and declare God's law through the mouth of avatar or prophet. These systems, more powerful and dynamic than the dry ethical idea, are yet for the most part no more than idealistic glorifications of the moral principle sanctified by religious emotion and the label of our superhuman origin. Some, like the extreme Christian ethic, are rejected by nature because they insist unworkably on an impracticable absolute rule. Others prove in the end to be evolutionary compromises and become obsolete in the march of time. The true divine law, unlike these mental counterfeits, cannot be a system of rigid ethical determinations that press into their cast iron molds all our life movements. The law divine is truth of life and truth of the spirit, and must take up with a free living plasticity and inspire with a direct touch of its eternal light each step of our action and all the complexities of our life issues. It must act not as a rule and formula, but as an enveloping and penetrating conscious presence that determines all our thoughts, activities, feelings, impulsions of will, by its infallible power and knowledge.
The older religions erected their rule of the wise, their dicta of Manu or Confucius, a complex shastra in which they attempted to combine social rule and moral law with the declaration of certain eternal principles of our highest nature in some kind of uniting amalgam. All three were treated on the same ground as equally the expression of everlasting verities, Sanatana Dharma. But two of these elements are evolutionary and valid for a time. Mental constructions, human readings of the will of the eternal. The third, attached and subdued to certain social and moral formulas, had to share the fortunes of its forms. Either the Shastra grows obsolete and has to be progressively changed or finally cast away, or else it stands as a rigid barrier to the self-government of the individual and the race. The Shastra erects a collective and external standard. It ignores the inner nature of the individual, the indeterminable elements of a secret spiritual force within him. But the nature of the individual will not be ignored. Its demand is inexorable. The unrestrained indulgence of his outer impulses leads to anarchy and dissolution. But the suppression and coercion of his soul's freedom by a fixed and mechanical rule spells stagnation or an inner death. Not this coercion or determination from outside, but the free discovery of his highest spirit and the truth of an eternal movement is the supreme thing that he has to discover.
The higher ethical law is discovered by the individual in his mind and will and psychic sense, and then extended to the race. The supreme law also must be discovered by the individual in his spirit. Then only through a spiritual influence and not by the mental idea can it be extended to others. A moral law can be imposed as a rule or an ideal on numbers of men who have not attained that level of consciousness or that fitness of mind and will and psychic sense in which it can become a reality to them and a living force. As an ideal, it can be revered without any need or practice. As a rule, it can be observed in its outsides, even if the inner sense is missed altogether. The supramental and spiritual life cannot be mechanized in this way. It cannot be turned into a mental ideal or an external rule. It has its own great lines, but these must be made real, must be the workings of an active power felt in the individual's consciousness and the transcriptions of an eternal truth powerful to transform mind, life, and body. And because it is thus real, effective, imperative, the generalization of the supramental consciousness and the spiritual life is the sole force that can lead to individual and collective perfection in Earth's highest creatures. Only by our coming into constant touch with the divine consciousness and its absolute truths can some form of the conscious divine, the dynamic absolute, take up our earth existence and transform its strife, stumbling, suffering, and falsities into an image of the supreme light, power, and Ananda.
The culmination of the soul's constant touch with the Supreme is that self-giving which we call surrender to the divine will and emergence of the separated ego in the One who is all. A vast universality of soul and an intense unity with all is the base and fixed condition of the supramental consciousness and spiritual life. In that universality and unity alone can we find the supreme law of the divine manifestation in the life of the embodied spirit. In that alone can we discover the supreme motion and right play of our individual nature. In that alone can all these lower discords resolve themselves into a victorious harmony of the true relations between manifested beings, who are portions of the one Godhead and children of one universal mother. Again, I found some things in here that reminded me of things in my life. He was talking about the later religions and how they try to fix a supreme standard of truth. And it reminded me of my time in the seminary. I was in a Catholic seminary for 10 years, including 4 years of theology. And at the time, it was right after the Second Vatican Council, and a man named Teilhard de Chardin was having a lot of influence on the Catholic Church. And of course, he has some similarities to Sri Aurobindo in his teaching. And the conflict that I remember was about moral theology. It was called moral theology. So it was a description of the standards of behavior, inner and outer behavior for Christians and for those who are training to be ministers to them. And there was a conflict between the kind of the old moral absolutes, what was a mortal sin and what was a venial sin and so on, with a more recent development in moral thinking and ethical thinking that was relativist. So there, those thinkers were saying that that you can't have an absolute standard that fits every situation, that the situation itself, the context of the situation, is going to be determinative, at least partly, into what is a true or right action. And there was a lot of conflict over that, proposal. And the professor that we had, my class had, for moral theology was a young priest who was kind of a rebel. And so he was promoting this more relativistic approach to morality, to the displeasure of some of the older professors.
Well, I suppose that this is partly why Aurobindo didn't want to create a religion, right? Because as soon as you create a religion, you create a set of dogmas about, you know, this is the whole difference between religion and spiritual practice, as opposed to a set of dogmas to follow, right? So.
I like also Teilhard de Chardin. I think there are a lot of similarities, and it would be also interesting to investigate the parallels and the differences, of course, also between him. I think in a certain sense, he is very actual, especially if we look at evolutionary biology, also in modern terms, there are interesting developments, recent developments. And of course, putting it in relation to the spiritual view, the sort of spiritual emergentism of Sri Aurobindo. Yeah. But yeah, just Teilhard de Chardin. I like him very much.
Actually, Amal Kiran wrote a book comparing Sri Aurobindo and Teilhard de Chardin. And it was based on his discussions over a number of years with a Benedictine monk who lived in Tamil Nadu, whose name was Bede Griffith, I think. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, Andrea, did you ever meet him?
I did not meet him, but I know of him.
Yeah. B. Sullivan had spent some time with him. And so it's interesting to... So Amal is kind of pushing in these conversations, kind of pushing Bede towards a recognition, because Bede also studied Sri Aurobindo as a Benedictine monk living in India, who knew of Teilhard de Chardin, but also knew Sri Aurobindo.
This was a remarkable little group of Benedictines who really opened themselves, who recognized the high wisdom in Indian spirituality and accepted that, saw the limitations of their own Christian belief set and tried to integrate things. Yeah. Yeah. So the one thing that comes to mind also to share with you that for Auroville, Mother had only one absolute no, and she said no religion in Oregon. And all the rest was flexible. It's like you follow your own truth, but no religion.
Are Benedictines allowed to enter Oroville or to make?
Of course. Or,
okay, just to know.
Of course.
Because at this point, I don't know. It was not so obvious for me, at least. Yeah.
One of my best friends in Oroville was a Franciscan priest.
Yeah.
And he helped build the Mater Mandir. He was also from Holland, by the way. Anyway, Ruud Lohman. Yeah. No, there are no such limitations. Okay.
Who's next time?
I'm reading.
You were mentioning these Benedictine priests, and I was thinking of another one. I don't know, maybe he wasn't Benedictine, I don't remember, but Gerard Manley Hopkins. So another of these rebellious priests from the beginning of the 20th century. He wrote poetry, but I mean, he tried to destroy some of his poetry later on in his life. So very much in the sort of non-rational side, I think, I guess, because it's more poetry than, extraordinary poetry.
Mm. You remind me of his name and I'll look it up sometime. All conduct and action are part of the movement of a power, a force infinite and divine in its origin and secret sense, and will, even through the forms of it we see, seem inconscient or ignorant, material, vital, mental, finite, which is working to bring out progressively something of the divine and infinite in the obscurity of the individual and collective nature. This power is leading towards the light, but still through the ignorance. It leads man first through his needs and desires. It guides him next through enlarged needs and desires, modified and enlightened by a mental and moral idea. It is preparing to lead him to a spiritual realization that overrides these things and yet fulfills and reconciles them in all that is divinely true in their spirit and purpose. It transforms the needs and desires into a divine will and ananda. It transforms the mental and moral aspiration into the powers of truth and perfection that are beyond them. It substitutes for the divided straining of the individual nature, for the passion and strife of the separate ego, the calm, profound, harmonious, and happy law of the universalized person within us, the central being, the spirit that is a portion of the Supreme Spirit. This true person in us, because it is universal, does not seek its separate gratification, but only asks in its outward expression in nature, its growth to its real stature, the expression of its inner divine self, that transcendent spiritual power and presence within it, which is one with all, and in sympathy with each thing and creature, and with all the collective personality and powers of the divine existence. And yet it transcends them and is not bound by the egoism of any creature or collectivity or limited by the ignorant controls of their lower nature. This is the high realization in front of all our seeking and striving. And it gives a sure promise of a perfect reconciliation and transmutation of all the elements of our nature. A pure, total, and flawless action is possible only when that is effected and we have reached the height of this secret Godhead within us.
The perfect supramental action will not follow any single principle or limited rule. It is not likely to satisfy the standard either of the individual egoist or of any organized group mind. It will conform to the demand neither of the positive practical man of the world, nor of the formal moralist, nor of the patriot, nor of the sentimental philanthropist, nor of the idealizing philosopher. It will proceed by a spontaneous outflowing from the summits in the totality of an illumined and uplifted being, will and knowledge, and not by the selected, calculated, and standardized action, which is all that the intellectual reason or ethical will can achieve. Its sole aim will be the expression of the divine in us and the keeping together of the world and its progress towards the manifestation that is to be. This even will not be so much an aim and purpose as a spontaneous law of the being and an intuitive determination of the action by the light of the divine truth and its automatic influence. It will proceed like the action of nature from a total will and knowledge behind her, but a will and knowledge enlightened in a conscious supreme nature and no longer obscure in this ignorant Prakriti. It will be an action not bound by the dualities, but full and large in the spirit's impartial joy of existence. The happy and inspired movement of a divine power and wisdom, guiding and impelling us, will replace the perplexities and stumblings of the suffering and ignorant ego.
If by some miracle of divine intervention, all mankind at once could be raised to this level, we should have something on earth like the golden age of the traditions, Satya Yuga, the age of truth or true existence. For the sign of the Satya Yuga is that the law is spontaneous and conscious in each creature and does its own works in a perfect harmony and freedom. Unity and universality, not separate division, would be the foundation of the consciousness of the race. Love would be absolute. Equality would be consistent with hierarchy and perfect indifference. Absolute justice would be secured by the spontaneous action of the being in harmony with the truth of things and the truth of himself and others, therefore sure of true and right result, right reason, no longer mental but supramental, would be satisfied not by the observation of artificial standards, but by the free automatic perception of right relations and their inevitable execution in the act. The quarrel between the individual and society, or disastrous struggle between one community and another, could not exist. The cosmic consciousness embedded in embodied beings would assure a harmonious diversity in oneness.
In the actual state of humanity, it is the individual who must climb to this height as a pioneer and precursor. His isolation will necessarily give a determination and a form to his outward activities that must be quite other than those of a consciously divine collective action. The inner state, the root of his acts, will be the same. But the acts themselves may well be very different from what they would be on an earth liberated from ignorance. Nevertheless, his consciousness and the divine mechanism of his conduct, if such a word can be used of so free a thing, would be such as has been described, free from that subjection to vital impurity and desire and wrong impulse, which we call sin, unbound by that rule of prescribed moral formulas, which we call virtue, spontaneously sure and pure and perfect in a greater consciousness than the mind's, governed in all its steps by the light and truth of the Spirit. But if a collectivity or group could be formed of those who had reached the supramental perfection, there indeed some divine creation could take shape. A new earth could descend that would be a new heaven. A world of supramental light could be created here amidst the receding darkness of this terrestrial ignorance.
That kind of sounds like a description by Sri Aurobindo of Mother's ideal for Oroville. To have a collectivity or a group to work towards this, however stumblingly that happens.
I find that sometimes it is, I mean, this last section clarifies all the rest of the section, why he said some things and so on. Sometimes I have the impression, at least I don't know if I'm the only one, but sometimes I have the impression that it's easier to understand a chapter by reading the last section and returning to the beginning and read it from all over again. Because this last section, if we take this as the ideal, the very far aim and ideal, and that is still possible at this stage of our evolution. But what he wrote before was, because he had this in the background as an ideal, otherwise would not make, well, no, it would make sense, but less sense. Now it acquires more vividly a meaning, the whole chapter. What's that about? The standard of conduct and spiritual freedom. Because previously it seemed that there is a sort of tension, of polarity, almost a contradiction that we have to put together somehow. Where here he says, in the supramental, well, there are these things disappear, this dichotomy. It is... Yeah, it disappears. Okay, sorry, I just tried to make a few words, summarize the entire chapter, but it's impossible.
I think that's probably why we read something, a chapter twice, right? Because then we have the whole run of his thought or vision and integrate it in the second reading.
And I see I was thinking today that I see the whole of the synthesis of yoga is like the theory of the supramental. You know, the theory, not in a derogatory sense, but mine, you know, throughout my career as a scientist, theory has always been the key element that allows you to do interesting work. Because if you don't have your theory right, no matter what you do experimentally, you're just feeling around in the dark. Whereas if you have a theory that you're working with, you can direct your questions and your understanding in ways that you couldn't do without the theory. So the theory is extremely important to the world of practice, because, you know, so it, you know, because a lot of practitioners sort of dispense with the theory, but I've always felt that practitioners, perhaps more than others, need to pay attention to theory, because theory gives to practice a whole different level of engagement that you don't have without the theory. And so I think, in a sense, this book is about the theory of the supramental, whereas The Secret of the Veda is about practice more, as we've discovered, Andrea. And Savitri is a kind of manifestation of this, and the life divine, I don't know what it is. It's the history, or it's theory in another way, but it's not this kind of theory.
Yeah, to me, it's the synthesis of yoga. It's both theory and practice. It skips from one thing to the other. But here, also in this chapter, you can see a practice. I mean, we should never... What is his central message in this chapter? He says we should never forget the soul dimension of the human being. The human being is not just a mind and a body. It is more than that. And if you ignore the soul dimension of the human being, everything will go astray. It will go end in disaster. I think, for example, in education, and sorry, I'm a bit fixed with this thing, but in education, we see that there is clearly the repression of the soul. That's people feel it. Because everything is standardized. Huh? Everything must do, they learn the same thing. They have the same curricula. They must make the same exam in the same time, etc. That this is a kind of mentality that ignores the soul dimension. This is just an example. And we forget this much too often. And the message is, don't forget that. Even though we are still egoistic animals and selfish, vital animals, and we cannot have this complete freedom like in an ideal supramental society where these rules and everything is harmonious. Sri Aurobindo was talking about, where is it in the Savitri? I don't know, of a divine anarchy. There's a divine anarchy. This is his, the ultimate goal. We are still not there because we have not sufficiently evolved. But nevertheless, in our society, when we do things, I think, for example, of parents. I don't have children. But parents, I should not judge. But because, since I don't have children, I shouldn't judge parents. But I sometimes see, I think, parents who see their child only as a mental, vital and bodily creature, and they don't see the soul, the necessity of the soul. Sounds very abstract now, if I say it in this way, but maybe
whoever doesn't have that knowledge or experience in themselves cannot possibly teach their children.
Yeah, precisely. That way. Exactly. Yeah.
I do feel that the synthesis. Sorry, you want to.
Yeah, no, I just was adding, here we get it perhaps at the mental level, okay, maybe, but already knowing it at the mental level may impel you to look inward and find it in you, and that would trigger the thing, okay. Yeah. Sorry, yeah. Go ahead, Andrea.
But it seems that what I am getting from the Vedas is that Indra brings the light of mind, and how necessary the illumined mind is to even begin to open and be interested in something more. And that the synthesis to me is very much a guide to open the mind to the whole vision and concept of supermind. You can't go and think about supermind if your mind isn't open to a more enlightened space, you know? Yeah.
Going back for a minute to schools, when I was in India, I went with my friend Parpana, who was doing research on integral education, to a school in Kerala. that I don't know if I ever told you all about this before, but it was, I think it was about the happiest place I've ever been at school. And the principles of the school included the recognition of the soul of the children, that each child was a unique being, unique divine being. But they put it into practice in a way that I've never seen it before. And I visited the ashram school. The Oroville schools were closed to visitors, so I was never allowed to go in and see how that worked. We had a meeting. We got to wander around the campus, and it's because they were putting on a science program for the parents, and so there some of the classes were very free form. And I remember we had Prapana and I had a conference with some of the teachers at the end of the day, and I asked them, how do you do this? Because what they were doing was they were really following. There were about four principles of the school, four guiding principles of the school, one of which is that the child always comes first. And they were extremely radical about that. And they told us stories about how they would follow that. Stories that I've never heard of similar things from any other school. And I said, how do you do this? Because you, when you went to school, you weren't trained like this. And they said, we have constant support. They have classes and mentoring going on all the time. So that they were learning with the kids at the same time how to do this. But it was a remarkable place. They told us during vacation times, it was a boarding school. During vacation times, some of the kids would run away from home to be back at the school. And the other thing I want to mention, this is a little strange to me, but the word supramental, I've read a lot of Sri Aurobindo and Mother about supramental. And in this reading and recent readings, instead of trying to hold in my mind what supramental is or could be, or I've just been reading it as beyond mind, higher consciousness beyond mind, that's it. And it's a kind of relief I've found in doing that. So when Sri Aurobindo in this chapter talks about the supramental consciousness and the supramental life, and if I just say, okay, I have a pretty good idea now what mind, in the way Sri Aurobindo speaks about it, is, and it's all its limitations. And it's just like, okay, it's beyond that. It's much higher than that, much more unified than that. It was kind of surprising that I felt a relief at doing that. It's surprising to me anyway.
Yeah, the word supramental kind of feels so out of reach, right? It's just like some kind of realm that, yeah, beyond us. But then you go beyond mind, I can imagine that too. Or we can experience that. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Andrea.
No, I'm going to wrap it. Go ahead.
Okay. Because I was thinking this morning about how the fact that July is almost finished, and then there's August, and normally in previous years, September would mean back to school. But since I'm now retired, I don't go back to school. And I was thinking, what a relief. And then I was thinking, yes, but as a young man, I loved going to school. When I was a student, I loved going to school. So when did it change for me? And I was thinking about that, and I thought, when it changed is when you had to do all those things that you were talking about, Marco, all those regulations and the exams. I hate giving exams. I've never given exams the way other people do. I've always varied up the way it's done to make it much more personal and direct for the students rather than a sort of standardized, you know, thing. And I still teach, but I don't teach like that anymore. And so I'm back to enjoying it, but I hate it, the sort of regulation of the teaching process. I mean, this whole idea of a standard way of learning, it only makes sense if you're trying to train people for, you know, I mean, the
school, for the army.
School system was developed to train people for standardized jobs in factories or, you know, bureaucracies or this kind of thing, which is why it was all standardized. But, you know, and true learning isn't standardized. So I prefer the Aurobindo spirit way of teaching, the one that doesn't have any dogmas. Yeah. I'm back to enjoying teaching, but it's been a shift.
So in terms of next time, I think we read twice this time. We went back and we read twice to paragraph 29. And so today we read the whole thing. And so from paragraph 29 to the end of this chapter, which is only a few pages, is our first time through. So I think maybe next time we should start with paragraph 29. I don't know what page that is for you. All conduct and action are part of the movement of the power, which is kind of the last part that you refer to, Marco, that kind of clarifies the whole chapter, that we start there and then continue with the supreme will with the next chapter. How does that sound?
I'm not sure I want to go back over what we read. Can we just start with the new chapter? I kind of feel like we've been over it quite a few, you know, maybe not fully in the same sense, but I kind of feel. I don't know how you guys feel, but
I felt the same thing, but then something came up and said, "This is the mind, which wants to categorize everything, cut in clear cut pieces, chapter by chapter. Why not putting it all upside down?" I said, "Okay, yeah," but. So I'm agnostic. I'll leave it to you because I had this double impulse and I don't know which of the two is a divine one.
Okay, John Robert, give us your wisdom.
No wisdom here, just a sense of I'm ready to move forward. Seemed like to me this last section was one of the easiest sections to understand. It was put together really beautifully, and not that the other ones weren't, but so I feel a movement forward.
Okay, moving forward is what we'll do.
That's the way I feel too. Movement forward.
Yeah. Also because I just wondering. We have to reach page 900 and so how many years will we still will take still some time, so if we go forward,
there's no rush.
no of course not.
I'm looking forward to some gray hairs on you, Marco.
Oh, there are, but it's, you know, the light, I've made it appropriately so that you don't see that.
But if you've had it long enough, we will get some gray hairs, I guess.
Yeah, there are some here, unfortunately. But we are actually now we have it's dark as night in Germany. I think you have so it's that's the reason that you don't see that.
Okay, start with chapter 8 next time.
Do we make a little meditation? Yeah, okay. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, everybody. That's a wonderful reading.
Very
nice
inspiring.
To be with you.
See you next time, 2 weeks.
Thank you all.
Bye-bye.
Bye.